Greetings. I'm Charles Vega, and I'm a clinical professor of family medicine here at the University of California at Irvine. And welcome to a short discussion about the 2017 guidelines from the American Heart Association and American College of Cardiology regarding hypertension and hypertension management. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by someone who should offer some real expertise in this area. That's Mike Blaha. He's an associate professor of medicine and also a member of the Division of Cardiology. And finally, he is the director of clinical research at the Ciccarone Center for the Prevention of Heart Disease at Johns Hopkins University. Mike, welcome.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here. Anxious to talk about these exciting guidelines.
Yeah. And so we were having a brief discussion about them online and then right before this taping that, yeah, I personally see the value of the guidelines. We know that there is an increase in the risk of cardiovascular events as the systolic blood pressure rises above, say, 115 millimeters of mercury, as diastolic rises above 75 millimeters of mercury. But I think what's blowing my mind and a lot of people's minds is just the fact that the sheer numbers of people who are affected by hypertension. So about 30% of U.S. adults have hypertension right now. But very importantly, the number I tend to fixate on is that just over half of them actually have their hypertension controlled. Now, with the new guidelines, which is the main, I think, headline from these guidelines is, you know, stage one hypertension can be defined as by a blood pressure as low as 130 millimeters over 80 millimeters of mercury. You're talking about adding 30 million more people into that pool of individuals with hypertension. Do you think we're ready to handle this as a medical system in terms of getting these patients the right types of screening and treatment?
It's going to be complicated for sure, and you're absolutely right. One of the big changes is that pre-hypertension group is now considered stage one hypertension.
Right.
What would have considered hypertension before is now that stage two hypertension group. So there's that new 130 to 140 systolic blood pressure group that we're more aggressively thinking about antihypertensive therapy in. And you're right, it's a big change. It makes a lot of people come into the fold of the diagnostic title of hypertension. It makes a lot of people who didn't have hypertension yesterday have hypertension today. But I can say without a doubt, like you said, it doesn't match the epidemiology. It matches the evidence. And it also, at least if nothing else, raises awareness to blood pressure. People who might have said my pressure's trending high before, now they're more aware of the blood pressure. Now, you're right, there's going to be a lot more people that are eligible for treatment. But I would point out that the guidelines do emphasize that for stage one hypertension, the first line therapy is still lifestyle therapy.
And they really emphasize those. They, you know, DASH diet, you know, in of itself can lower systolic blood pressure by over 10 millimeters of mercury, depending on which study you're looking at. So we know that that can be a very, very powerful tool and get patients right out of that hypertensive range. In clinical practice, I'm not sure that we always reach that kind of efficacy.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, lifestyle doesn't always work. But so that's why I think it's more of an awareness than anything else. It's telling you that stage one hypertension, you need to think harder about that patient. It doesn't say you have to treat them right away with a pharmacologic therapy, but you have to think and have that discussion. But I will say another unique part of this guidelines I'm sure we'll come to is the risk-guided nature of the guidelines. For example, in that stage one hypertensive group, it says if your ASCVD risk score is less than 10% over 10 years, then you're going to think less aggressively about pharmacologic therapy. And if the blood pressure, the ASCVD risk is above 10%, you're going to think more aggressively about blood pressure therapy. So it's bringing that risk back into the blood pressure guidelines, just like as we talked about before, brought it into the cholesterol guidelines. So we're going to be treating high-risk patients more aggressively. And maybe that low-risk patient that's in the stage one hypertensive group is that great patient to emphasize, well, any of everything from weight loss to physical activity, DASH diet, potassium supplementation, a treatment of sleep apnea, et cetera, things that do work to some degree for lowering the blood pressure.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. And so we're not going to be, you know, managing 26-year-olds who may just have overweight as their only risk factor. And so we're not going to be maybe going after them as aggressively with pharmacotherapy. But I think there's a back end to that, because this isn't necessarily going to change my management for those patients who are very sick, have a very high 10-year cardiovascular risk, but unfortunately are also frail and already on antihypertensive therapy. But say they're on dialysis, and every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, their blood pressure bottoms out, you know, their systolic goes to 80, and they get dizzy coming out of that dialysis center. That's a real risk for them. So I think guidelines are just that. They're a demarcation of where we should try to aim. But of course, your individual results may vary patient to patient. So I think about that certainly with our younger low-risk patients, but also our older and more, and particularly just more frail patients. We don't necessarily need to push them down, particularly if there's side effects such as presyncope or risk of falling.
Yeah, I think this is one aspect we will struggle a little bit with these guidelines, which is as we lower that blood pressure threshold, more and more older adults, or essentially almost all older adults, will be at least stage 1 hypertensive at some stage. And also, When you add that risk element in, risk is highly dependent on age too. So it's really pushing us towards more aggressive treatment of older individuals, which sometimes I agree with, sometimes I don't. So you're right, that's because there's going to be some tension there in the older adult of how do we balance these guidelines and the sprint results in general. That showed that more aggressive therapy in high-risk patients is a good thing, with the idea that older folks also have more side effects of therapy.
You know, speaking of tension, these guidelines really promote the concept of measuring the blood pressure outside of the medical office. And, you know, really 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure readings can give us some incredibly valuable information, or just at-home readings taken outside the office. How do you see, you know, the practical implementation of reading blood pressure outside of the medical office, particularly in the light of all these new individuals who may come into the fold, as you say, with new stage 1 hypertension?
Well, I actually love this part of the guidelines, because I know you probably agree with me that the in-office-based blood pressure, especially when it might not be taken by yourself, or maybe you might repeat it and it's different from when they checked in, it's just so hard to use. So I'm really not a big fan of the office-based blood pressure, or at least full reliance on it. So I love the idea of out-of-office blood pressure measurement. And like you said, that can take two forms. That can take the form of a patient taking their blood pressure at home and creating a blood pressure log, which I love. Also, the occasional use of 24 ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. So that's particularly to look for, I guess, the two groups of masked hypertension and the white hypertension, right? So masked hypertension, you might miss in the office, but really when you look at those home blood pressure logs, you see measurements that are way out of range. But also that white coat hypertensive, who in your office is always high, assures you that at home it's always normal. And indeed, sometimes you get that 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure cuff, and their blood pressure is normal. So it's going to help. It's going to reclassify some patients, right? We're both changing the categories of blood pressure, but we're going to reclassify some people based on the allowance of home blood pressure monitoring. But I love home blood pressure monitoring. I always ask my patients to bring in blood pressure logs. I feel uncomfortable sometimes making decisions based on one blood pressure meeting in the office. I think that has the potential to get patients' engagement up, which I think is a big part of this too.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think just knowing their numbers a little bit better, being able to have some sense of control over the measurement of this illness that they're either diagnosed with or in the diagnostic process for is absolutely important. And that might help down the line with treatments you recommend, whether it be a lifestyle or medications. But I just have a question about how many, in terms of a percentage of patients, do you think will really need that more ambulatory blood pressure monitoring as opposed to just the, blood pressure at home checks once a day or three times a week?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think when you're getting discrepancies, you might have to move to an ambulatory blood pressure cuff, right? Someone, and you get this in your clinic, I do too. Some patients assure you that their home is one thing, and then you bring them into the office, it's a different thing. Or the someone who's in your office is always discrepant from their home readings on the high side, the white coats. So I really think it's going to be for those discrepant situations where you need more information, or maybe a patient doesn't have a home blood pressure cuff, for example. So sure. I think the answer is not that often, but it's going to be for select people, it'll be very helpful.
Oh, absolutely. I can see we know from research there's a lot of benefits to that ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. The intensity of is I think counterbalanced by the fact that you can really make some better treatment decisions and prevent, cardiovascular events for those individuals. This is a brief talk, but it was really great. I think that we determined that we have some very evidence-based guidelines. I think they tend to be a little bit more patient-centered because of that risk assessment that's involved, and they emphasize lifestyle very appropriately. The blood pressure out of the office readings, very important as well. But it will be a challenge for us as a medical system to take all these patients in and really try to move that needle of appropriate blood pressure management towards the good. Mike, I know you're working on it every day, so thank you very much for everything you do.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. And thanks to everybody who's watched this episode. Look forward to more in the future.